This is continuing with Cyril Hazard on 20 March 73. Well, along this same general line, what about the cooperation between optical astronomers and radio astronomers? In the early 50s, there was only Bader and Bach, and yet a different sort of...
Minkowski, I think.
And Minkowski.
Yeah. Minkowski, in fact, was the only one that I knew, really. In fact, I think that probably Minkowski was probably the more important one.
Was this because the optical astronomers just didn't understand anything of what was going on, or they just didn't see its importance, or...?
I think they probably didn't see its importance. Well, I think there were probably several things. I think, you know, the positions were really so atrocious that were being provided,
they couldn't be bothered.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was a long time, even after QSOs, that, you know, it was a pretty time-consuming job for them if you were giving them bad positions when they're getting such a small amount of time on the big telescopes. And Minkowski and Bader, of course, got into the act with the when the reasonably accurate positions came along for Cygnus and Cassiopeia. It strikes me, you know, maybe it was because Bader died not all that long afterwards, I suppose, but Minkowski seemed to play a bigger part in it round about that time, and certainly he was the only one that I knew, you know, that I'd met, I would guess, round about that time. Apart from Oort, of course, I mean, it was along rather different lines.
Apart from whom?
Oort, you know.
Oort, yeah.
But I mean, that was a rather different line.
And Bach is also another.
Yeah. But but I think it was just the fact that radio people really didn't have the data to contribute at that particular time. And it was only when really accurate positions started to come along. I mean, there were people like Dewhurst and so on that were doing something, you know, in the later stages. There was... Once sources were coming along, I think that the they were trying to identify things. A lot of the stuff they did was right, like the fact that they were saying there were elliptical galaxies in those places and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I think that radio galaxies were getting reasonably well understood. But I don't think that one can... I mean, I think it's what you said, the time really wasn't right for the optical cooperation until the radio techniques themselves, by themselves, had developed as a subject by itself, until the technical competence had been achieved to start to contribute. And I think that as soon as that happened, I think that really what happened was that not only did the optical people come in, I think, but the evolution of people, you know, radio astronomy started to begin ceasing, you know, to be a separate compartment. It started to move into the mainstream of astronomies, you know. I mean, it had done already on the line work and so on, but in the ordinary extragalactic stuff, I mean, it started to move into the thing, and then I think that the people began to change. I mean,
Do you think the hydrogen line work was more into the mainstream of astronomy earlier than the radio source?
Well, I think so, because, I mean, in the sense that... In the sense that theoreticians and optical astronomers, or people who are experienced in optical astronomy, took part in it from the beginning. And it required that, I think, the people who understood the galaxy and so on to take part in it. So that was probably a fairly fortunate development, the way that particular one occurred here. And I think people like Bach and people like Oort and so on came into it because of that. Although, I mean, there were things that were being done, like Westerhout and so on, were tackling the source distributions and so on, as to the significance of those. But again, in terms of the fact that they were in the galaxy, as to when it was accepted they were outside the galaxy, I'm absolutely certain. I wouldn't even be surprised, actually, if the first categorical statement, you know, backed up by some evidence, isn't in the paper that I put in Observatory. It's not a paper, it's a... somebody of a conference at Jodrell.
This is the one in 55?
It must have been about 54 or 55. I mean, I was absolutely convinced they were extragalactic by 52 or 53. You know, a long time before, you know, it was moving that way. Certainly by 53.
But there was a great debate going on.
Sure, there was a great debate going on.
There was a
big debate going on, and Orion and so on was in the forefront of them being galactic. I certainly finished my thesis in 54, and I must have had the idea straight by 53, and I was categorical as though extragalactic by then. Gold had been suggesting it already, Solvay conference and so on in London and so on. And in fact, if looking back, the arguments that Gould and Hoyle and so on were producing at that time were pretty convincing, except people didn't listen to them, I don't think. But although, you know, that you needed to up the contributions over normal galaxies by a big amount, it was really a much smaller figure than you needed to up it over the stars and so on. So that, but again, you know, the evidence wasn't there at the time. And
it was only a sort of a plausibility.
Yeah. And but I think that I'd done calculations on between my teeth and printed some of them at that thing, which showed you could explain everything fairly straightforwardly if they were extragalactic and with the same sort of density. You know, yeah. Extragalactic with some sort of dispersion. And I think that by that time there must have been, you know, it's very difficult to tell because.
Well, I suppose another point is that there was, of course, a much longer tradition in astronomy on galactic astronomy. Extragalactic astronomy was a relatively new field.
It was completely new, really. It's difficult to remember.
And it was not
so
much known about it. So and all the radio people were working in extragalactic, and it was very hard to see the tie-in, whereas there was a sufficient background in a galactic optical astronomy that they could
Well, I think that's possibly true. That I think it may be, of course, that possibly it's because radio astronomy got underway in England and here in Australia. And the only people in any extragalactic astronomy were in the States. It's, I mean, you know, they were in
Celtic. Well, that's an interesting point, too.
It may have been that if, in fact, it got underway in the States more easily, it might have been been very much different. I mean, it might have been very much different if Bolton had actually started off his radio astronomy career in California and not in Sydney, and the first step had been dealt with in California. It's possible.
Yeah.
That people might have, who were interested in extragalactic, might have, you know, looked on things as extragalactic from the beginning. You can't tell.
There were a couple early groups, but they were not in California. They were in the East Coast.
Yeah, and they didn't do a great deal.
And they didn't do extragalactic work. They worked on the sun and the moon.
That's right.
And planets. And
But it's possible, you see, that if somebody had been doing these source surveys and had, in fact, been discussing, talking all the time with extragalactic people, that these possibilities might have come more to the fore, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possible, you can't tell.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's quite right, I suppose. And I mean, in that particular sense, it may be that I was fairly inclined to have some extragalactic in that I've done all my work on extragalactic stuff almost from the beginning of normal galaxies.
Well, so it's only natural, right?
Mm, so that you
one tends to make the data want to fit his area
that's right.
Of expertise.
That's right. At least you're not... you're not frightened of it anyhow, you have some familiarity with the terms and so on at least.
Okay, well let's go back, I guess coming back from Australia, then what did you work on and what was going on at General Bank?
Well, I didn't go to General Bank, I went to Arecibo then.
You went to Arecibo, okay.
Yeah.
And this is what year now?
I went to Australia at the end of 1960, I think, and left Australia in 63, I suppose, 63, end of 63, something like that. And went to Arecibo where they were just getting underway, and it happened there that there was an occultation of 273 occurring there about 3 weeks after I arrived.
I see.
And so
the dish was operational?
The dish was operational. We had nothing up there to do it with. We wanted to really have a bash at a really good small angular size measurement. For that, we didn't want to use the whole dish, and so I built a multi-frequency feed, a three nest of three feeds, which in fact survived for several years after. We knocked this together in about a week, and it worked very well. We got, you know, it just turned out resolution down about 0.1 of a second, and we got the observation at 40 megacycles, which was, you know, certainly by far the, you know, the only time anyone's got around about 10 seconds of arc resolution, 40 megacycles. And then we did, then we started to develop that for occultations, did quite a lot. I mean, the occultations up there and got that going underway, but we were more interested in, I suppose, that particular time in the theory of the stuff in many ways. Yeah. Although I think that it was fairly, I'll tell you what did happen then, once we got the first occultation, there are small ones, the fact that you could in fact use the doubles, I mean I suggested that then, that the doubles were the right way to do the angular size measurements, that was fairly obvious right in the beginning of the paper there.
I don't see exactly
well,
what
I mean, the idea at that particular time was to do cosmology by measuring angular sizes, and we were trying to do it exactly.
Oh, to use the separation of doubles.
Yeah, separation of doubles. And that was obviously what I suggested doing that. And in fact, a lot of the stuff that I did round about then, you know, has only really been repeated then, but it turned out it was presented in the fourth Texas Symposium, which the proceedings never appeared for some reason or other. It's only in the CRSR report, and I forgot about it, you know, for a couple of years. Because I always thought this other thing was going to come out, and it's never appeared since then. But a lot of the stuff on structures of QSOs and so on is in there, which has only reappeared in the last few years, that was number 1967. But anyhow, that... so, and then... and what else were we doing then? We were trying to develop new feeds, trying to look at spectra and measure positions and so on, because then after about 18 months then I moved up to Whisker.
What was the main purpose of building the astronomical purpose for the Arecibo dish?
Well, Arecibo was built originally to do backscatter measurements by Bill Gordon on the ionosphere.
Right, but with no astronomy in mind at that time?
Not really. I mean, well, yes, radar astronomy, because, I mean, there was obviously interest in doing radar of the planets, you know, on the moon and so on, and of course a lot of his time was and is still devoted to that. But I don't think there was any great thought given to astronomy, and obviously there wasn't. I mean, because nobody who was going to build an astronomical facility would cut it off at 38 degrees when Andromeda was, you know,
mm-hmm.
2 or 3 degrees further north. Obviously you'd have made sure you got Andromeda in. So, I mean, it's fairly obvious, I think, that there wasn't a great deal of thought at that particular time given to the...
Well, how did this change? Was there someone that...
I don't know exactly how it changed. You know, there was a political upheaval around about that time. I don't want to discuss the wrongs and rights of it all, because actually I wasn't there at the time. I just sort of arrived at the tail end of this. You know, which ended with Booker leaving Cornell and Bill Gordon and so on, and Tommy Golden, I'm taking over. So presumably the idea of moving it over to astronomy basically was the arrival of Gold as professor of astronomy and so on in Ithaca. I mean, I presume that was what, but I don't know.
Hmm.
I mean, Marshall Korn was there and he was down there. And so there were a few people tend to do astronomy. They'd already done one or two occultations. I think they had Kundu was there. There were a few people doing it. But obviously, I don't think they probably had any say in the building the thing in the beginning.
Yeah.
It was an electrical engineering project to begin with. But then, you know, I mean, again, that's fairly obvious in that the whole of the effort in which, you know, in some ways held back the development of the facilities for radioastronomical thing was predicated on the fact that one wanted a feed which would feed the whole dish high power two polarizations. I mean, now that people have gone over to building single polarization feed 500 or 600 feet of this radio astronomy, things work perfectly, and it could have probably been developed earlier on, I think. I would guess if that had been tackled. You know, there was no particular use made until the last few months. I mean, you know, I started it several years ago, and it's only got going now, and we're doing it now to use the multiple beaming facility. You know,
ten
overlapping beams where you can do surveys really quickly. So all that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, hadn't really been developed and is only really coming into operation now. And of course, it will improve, I suppose, a lot now that they're upgrading the dish, which was my original motivation for going to multi-beaming in many ways. You know, to get over the fact you wouldn't be able to track accurately enough.
Yeah.
The single one. That looks very promising. And of course, Arecibo was given a very big boost then, of course, again by pulsars. Simply, you know, not simply because, but I mean to a large extent because it had all of the recording and equipment available for radar work, and it just set up like perfectly for it.
Had the great sensitivity at low frequencies.
It had the great sensitivity at low frequencies, but I mean even more than that, I think.
And also
it,
timing.
It had all the equipment was there, used for radar work.
For timing and so forth.
Recording, right. And everything, rapid recording, timing,
analyzing, yeah.
everything was there. And so it was really ideally placed.
That's right.
For yeah. this, and they didn't need the resolution, you didn't need terrible tracking accuracy, and so everything was pretty well set up for that. And,
well, I don't want to go beyond there. I'm going to cut this thing off sometime around 65 or...
Yeah.
Because it just gets out of hand, obviously.
It just gets out of hand after that, yeah.
But is there anything else that...
No, but there is, I think...
Earlier than... Or,
no, well. But I think that the... I think that, you know, the point about the mid-1960s, I think, is fairly important, simply because, possibly slightly before that and round about that time, there's a very important change occurring, I think, in radio astronomers as such. I mean, in certain groups of radio astronomers, I think that the people who are really working on things like QSOs and so on are starting in many ways to diverge, you know, from the ordinary radio astronomical things. I mean, they're becoming more astronomers and not radio astronomers anymore. I think at least, you know, you're becoming more interested in the optical work and working with optical, you know, with the optical observers. It's obvious that the radio itself is only a very small part of the whole thing. A plus on top of that, I mean, that the instruments are reaching such a point that you're not building them anymore, and a lot of the pleasure of doing radio astronomy is gone. You know, that you don't have any particular satisfaction
right.
in going and pressing buttons on some instrument.
Well, as you know, you cannot press buttons at a place like Vestibar.
That's right. Well, I mean, so that nearly all of the interest that used to exist in radio astronomy of going and building a receiver and building an antenna and connecting it up and making it work and seeing the sources come through, and that in itself being an achievement apart from anything else. And then you could write a thing and say, well, these are the positions of the sources. In fact, that was an achievement in those days. You didn't have to do any astronomy as such afterwards to justify it. But now, I mean, you can't... people do, I think, but I don't see how anyone can take any credit for going to any instrument now and measuring the fluxes of so many sources or measuring the positions
right.
of so many sources. It doesn't strike me that that's a contribution whatsoever.
Right. You've got to interpret it.
You've got to interpret it. And so, I mean, people have got to become much more problem-oriented.
Right.
And I think that this sort of thing was starting to take place
in the 1960s. I agree with you. I think, don't you think it happens simultaneously with the largeness of the facilities? Where, like you say, one person could not build it and still be able to do the astronomy.
It's happening simultaneously with that, but it's also happening, I think, with the significance of the results that are coming out. I think that while you had a set of unidentified radio sources and one could play about in cosmology and so on, then this was a radio astronomical problem as such. You know, that it could reach certain conclusions, might or might not be right, but you only needed the radio data and you needed very little else to go on, except in a general sort of way. Once you reached the quasar sort of stage and so on, then the objects that you were finding had great intrinsic importance, and the investigation was only beginning with the radio investigation. And I think if you were working in those sort of fields, you began to get resentful, really, and felt it was silly that you were cut off from the further development to a certain extent. So to appreciate, once you'd found quasars, or once you'd found pulsars, I mean, any of those things, to really appreciate what you'd done, or to get the full satisfaction from it, you really had to go a lot further.
Yeah.
You had to start to understand the optical stuff, and you had to take part in it. You had to start to understand, the implications of it, and if you were doing pulsars, no doubt you wanted to understand all about neutron stars and so on. So the whole thing was developing away from radio astronomy, and so, you know, perhaps you're right. I mean, maybe that's the point to stop, because radio astronomy is a subject you could almost argue ceases to exist at that time.
Yeah, well, I can think another way of putting it is that it becomes less and less engineering and more science.
That's more and more science, yeah.
Because from what you said, the great part of the joy was in the engineering part.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And
building a receiver which would do it and getting it out.
Right. Whereas someone like me...
building an antenna or something, you know.
Or building an antenna, right. You don't even think about building an antenna these days.
No, but it was something. It was interesting. Get out with the wires and soldering irons, a concrete mixer. You enjoyed it. Well, you have to do something else now. So
that's right.
So maybe, so there is a thing, I mean, perhaps, you know, maybe, you know, there's no difference in using Westerbork to using an optical telescope. There's nothing much different you do with the results when you've got them. You know?
So, that's true.
So that, so it's sort of silly to say, you're an optical astronomer, you might as well call yourself, you know, a blue plate astronomer, or,
yeah,
you know, yeah, or a red shield astronomer.
That's a very good point.
And so, you know, it might be that that's the mid-1960s sort of the time that radio astronomy as such became of age and just became a part of astronomy, I suppose, which is a good thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Right. That finishes the interview with Cyril Hazard on 20th March 1973 at Groningen.